Welcome, everyone. It is very good to be with you, and it is especially very good to be with Malalai Joya, who took 4 flights to be with us today, came across the world. And if the fact that she is here teaches us anything, it is that protest works and that solidarity matters. And we need a lot more of it. Malalai will now be on tour in the United States, despite efforts to keep her from having her voice heard. But a concerted campaign made sure she is here. You can find out more about where she'll be on her tour by going to AfghansWomenMission.org. I'll just highlight one stop along the way. She's going to San Francisco April 10th to be part of the UNAC anti-war demonstration taking place April 10th in San Francisco. For those of you who are on the East Coast and will be on the East Coast the day before New York, UNAC is also having an anti-war demonstration starting at noon in Union Square. Malalai will speak first, followed by Noam. Malalai will be able to stay after the event. There'll be a book signing right down here in front. And if you want to get your book signed, and you can also purchase a copy of the new paperback of her book, A Woman Among Warlords, which I can't recommend highly enough. A few people I want to thank, the co-sponsors of tonight's program, the Harvard College Human Rights Advocates, Harvard GLOW, Harvard International Relations on campus, the United National Anti-War Committee, Code Pink, Massachusetts Peace Action, the Pakistan-Afghanistan Task Force, International Women's Rights Collective, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and then a special thanks to our presenting organizations, the International Socialist Organization and the Harvard Palestine Solidarity Committee. I want to briefly introduce someone who was instrumental in ensuring that Malalai is here and is speaking to you tonight at Harvard, Giacomo Bagarella.
Thank you. My name is Giacomo Bagarella. I am one of the co-chairs of the Harvard College Palestine Solidarity Committee, and I'm very happy to be here and to have worked on this project. Before I say a couple words about the event, I would like to thank Mr. Richard Campbell, Sexton of Memorial Church, Mr. Doug Whalo, the manager of the SALC, the Office of Student Life at Harvard, Haymarket Books, all the other co-sponsoring organizations, and of course, Professor Chomsky and Ms. Joya. As a part of Harvard students and community members who follow events in the Middle East closely, let me tell you what this event means to us. One of the goals we strive for is the correct representation of issues in the Middle East. And to do this, we also have to work with non-mainstream members who will share their experience and insight with audiences at the college. Today, we have the opportunity to host Malalai Joya, who will certainly be able to bring to us her incredible perspectives based on personal experience and engagement, which are quite different from the ones of American politicians and military leaders who usually get to speak at Harvard. We also have to hear today Mr. Noam Chomsky, a man who has been holding the front line on many contentious topics in the United States. This event to us means that is a reward for all of the effort we have been putting into this and the preparations, and it is a chance to hear from two extraordinary sources what our countries, I'm Italian and I assume most of you are American, what our countries do in foreign territory and foreign wars, and whether what we have been told so far is accurate or not. It is most fitting that the woman called the bravest woman in Afghanistan is speaking in what they call the home of the brave, and so I'm really happy to be here and I thank you all for coming.
Keep this very brief. I'm sorry, I should introduce myself before. I'm Anthony Arnov. I work with Haymarket Books. We're also one of the sponsors of tonight's program. And because we are all here to see Malalai, I'll just leave it at that. Malalai, please.
I'm too short. Hello and good evening, everyone. Very nice to meet you all. First of all, I would like to thank supporters of Haymarket Books, Harvard Palestine Solidarity Committee, Harvard College Human Rights Advocates, Harvard Law, Harvard International Relations on COMPASS, United for Justice with Peace, Afghanistan and Pakistan Task Force, Massachusetts Peace Action, United National Anti-War Committee, International Socialist Organization, and International Women's Rights Collective, who organized this event and gave me this opportunity to talk about the ongoing tragedy in my crying country, and also about the realities of the so-called war on terror by US and NATO and brutalities of Islamic fundamentalists. I want to tell you that I'm so happy and glad that I attended this event with extraordinary anti-war, peace-loving, democratic-minded activist, Professor Noam Chomsky. I believe that Mr. Chomsky is not only the real representative of justice-loving, peace-loving American people, and also he's the voice of the voiceless people in the war countries, suffer people in the war countries, oppressed people, including my country, Afghanistan. If your government, if your people have warmongers like Obama or criminal like Bush, but you must be very proud, you should be very proud for a person like Chomsky and many other Chomskys that you have here and raise their voice strongly against the wrong policy of your government against warmongers for democracy and peace. When I hear that US government denied give me visa, one reason that I become concerned, I become sad, was that I will not meet you, Professor Chomsky. So on behalf of my people now, I post their love and their happiness and their support to you. Your articles, your writings not only gives strength, hope, progressive intellectuals, freedom-loving, justice-loving, freedom-loving fighters in Afghanistan, and I'm sure millions around the world. From this opportunity, I would like to thank all my those supporters and friends who put pressure on their government to give me visa and bring the message of suffer poor people of my country to you and raise my voice against the wrong policy of your government, against occupation for women rights and human rights. For years, few years ago, the US puppet regime in Kabul, they imposed ban on my travel abroad. And now a US government, they refuse to give me visa. I want to tell you from your podium that no one can stop me from telling the truth, and I will continue to spread my message. To bring the message of my people to you and continue until the last of my breath against continue to this struggle against occupation, against fundamentalist warlords, and also Taliban. 10 years ago, US and NATO invaded my country under the beautiful banner of women rights, human rights, and democracy. But today we are as far from these values as were in 2001. Kidnapping, rape cases, domestic violences, Assyria attacks, killing of women increasing rapidly, even historical. The only difference with the domination of Taliban is this: all of these crimes are happening under the name of democracy, women rights, human rights. They are giving bad view about this values to my people. The reason that the US government, they refused to give me visa, I think, was that because I exposed the wrong policy of your government, and also I talk about the realities of the so-called war on terror of this 10 years that all of these war crimes that your government commit, they are under the name of American people. And Also, I inform you about the taxpayer money, that billions of dollars that giving to Karzai's puppet mafia regime. Most of these money goes into pocket of these warlords, drug lords, criminals, not benefit Afghan people. These are what I briefly told you, the reasons that they afraid of me and do not let me to enter the U.S. But I want to tell you again that your show of solidarity gives us more hope, more courage, more determination, and it means that you gave the helping hand to pro-democracy and anti-fundamentalist movement of my country. Mainstream media always, they talk about situation of the women in Afghanistan, that it improved a lot, but right now in most of provinces of Afghanistan, women even, they do not have human life. Killing of women that much easy for the warlords, like killing a bird. Let me give you a few examples of the catastrophic situation of the woman. For example, recently a 17-year-old girl, she has been brutally raped by a head of the provincial council in Kunar province. And a brave local lawyer want to follow this case, but she received death threats from this powerful warlords, and nobody, he do not dare to continue this case. And also that another woman, a couple in Ghazni province, they has been stoned to death. They has been killed by throwing a stone to them. And also another young Afghan woman in Ghor province, she has been beaten by lashes. And many other examples that seem like Taliban time, we have jungle condition. Situation of the woman day by day goes from worse to worse. They are not only women, men and women today, both of them do not have liberation at all, and millions, they suffer from injustice, insecurity, corruption, joblessness, poverty. And right now, this is not only military war in Afghanistan, this is war of propaganda as well. And for example, even US government and NATO, they misuse from the miseries of Afghan women. Maybe you hear the story of Bibi Aisha in Time magazine, that they titled, gave report about this cruelty of her husband, who cut the nose and ears of Bibi Aisha. Tell to their people what will happen to the woman if we leave Afghanistan. But it was better if they wrote what's happening to the woman while we are in Afghanistan. Many other examples regarding catastrophic situation of the woman. If later, if we had time, I will share with you more examples that day by day these disasters getting more. But many people ask me from every audience that how we can help Afghan women. My answer always is this: first of all, war will never help Afghan women, and secondly, if they give a little bit chance to Afghan men and women, we know what to do with our destiny, and progressive Afghan men will help us to bring women rights in our country. During these 9 years of occupation, tens of thousands of innocent civilians has been killed by US and NATO occupation forces. Most of them are innocent women, children, and men. Even they use white phosphorus cluster bomb there. And I think you agree with us that democracy never came by military invasion, by support of these misogynist warlords and also Taliban, and also by support of these, by to tell you better, by throwing bomb, by white phosphorus or cluster bomb. When Obama took office, unfortunately, his first news for my people was more conflict, more war, because his foreign policy is quite similar like criminal Bush, even worse, because he surged more troops in Afghanistan, which brought more miseries and more disaster in my country. And also, during this 2 years, Obama proved himself as a warmonger for my people. To prove this fact, it was during Obama's office that the civilian death toll increased by 24% in the drone attacks in Pakistan, has got many innocent lives too. And also the outcome of these blind bombardment is the innocent civilians, massacres, violences, destruction, pains, and tragedies. It seems that shedding blood of countless innocent people was not enough in Iraq and Afghanistan, that now Obama's administration again used the UN as their umbrella to invade Libya as well, under the same familiar false banners of democracy and human rights. While the US people are suffering as a result of the economic crisis and living conditions are getting worse, the Pentagon wages another brutal war which will only benefit the US corporate and billionaires to loot the oil and other riches of the Libya. Obama raised hue and cry against Gaddafi's non-democratic regime and also his crimes, while is supporting much more dirty Gaddafis and criminal regimes in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Israel, Saudi Arabia, and many other countries of the world. The documents released by WikiLeaks prove what we have been saying about war in Afghanistan, exposed the treachery policy of the US, the wrong policy of the US and NATO in my country. And they kill innocent people under the name of the Taliban, then through mainstream media shamelessly decrease the number of the civilian deaths and call them insurgents, terrorists. Even they insult the dead body of my people. Maybe you hear the report of Spiegel recently. That's why for my people, Obama is a second and dangerous push, because he invites terrorist Taliban, a fascist man like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who his name is in the blacklist of the US, to join this puppet, corrupt mafia regime of Hamid Karzai. If these two terrorists also come in power, the circle of warlordism, draglordism, terrorism will be complete, and again, innocent people of my people, my country, especially women, will be the victim. Now, Karzai's regime full of the warlords, draglords, and criminals who imposed on my people and day by day getting powerful. And Afghanistan is ranked 181st out of 182 countries in the Human Development Index. And according to the Mines Minister, Afghanistan is sitting on around $3 trillion of mineral deposits, but because it's the second most corrupt country in the world, the income of these mines wouldn't fill the pockets of the government officials and also warlords. In these 9 years, they have changed Afghanistan to the center of the drug. Since 2001, 4,400% opium increase in Afghanistan. Even brother of Hamid Karzai, Ahmad Wali Karzai, recently New York Times gave report that he is a famous drug trafficker and also in the payroll of CIA. And the US and NATO themselves are engaged in this dirty business, which pours hundreds of billions of dollars into the pocket of Western institutions engaged in it. US and NATO try to fool Afghans and also their own people too, by saying that they will start leaving Afghanistan by mid of 2011. But from another hand, the puppet regime of Karzai is speaking about permanent military base in Afghanistan. We know that they occupied my country because of their own strategic, regional, and economic interests, and they will not leave Afghanistan soon. They keep the situation of my country lawless and unsafe to have an excuse for you justice-loving great people of the US and around the world to stay longer in my country for their own interests. No one can believe that a superpower with massive military machine is really unable to defeat the Taliban, this bunch of terrorists who created by US government, and their domination has been destroyed as well, and still they are playing the game of Tom and Jerry with these dinosaurs. It has been proved for, I think, not only for Afghan people, now it's open secret for the people around the world as well, that even during these 9 years, directly and indirectly, they already supported the Taliban. Taliban already in power. Also, photocopy of the Taliban, these fundamentalist warlords. And still, they support Taliban mainly through Pakistan. I think justice-loving people of the world agree with me that democracy never comes by bombing innocent civilians, supporting a corrupt government and empowering a bunch of brutal and dark-minded warlords. We don't want such democracy, and if the Western powers continue to impose this kind of dictatorship under the name of democracy on my people, our people may have no option but to rise against occupation. Right now, there is two kinds of resistance going on in my country. One is the reactionary resistance of the Taliban that always US and NATO, they try to make something out of a mountain out of molehill. Another is resistance of ordinary Afghan people, resistance of a student of the university, resistance of the suffer innocent people, men and women, who join their hands together with the banner that they have used out of Afghanistan. Now they come on the streets, despite there is no security, they raise their voice against occupation. When Democratic Party, which name is Afghan Solidarity Party, they had demonstration there recently in Afghanistan. And hundreds of people in many provinces of Afghanistan joined their demonstration. Recently in Konar province, 64 innocent civilians has been killed by blind bombardment of the US government. Also, maybe you hear this report, and it also recently happened, 9 children again in Konar province, they has been killed. After all of these war crimes, White House says apologize, Karzai's regime says thank you, that is it. We fed up with listening, apologizing, thank you. We want the end of this occupation as soon as possible. And I believe that the only solution to Afghanistan is that the troops should withdraw, because their presence is making our fight for justice much harder by empowering reactionary, brutal, and dark-minded forces that are great obstacles for the true democratic elements. Afghan people now, they squashed between 3 enemies: Taliban, warlords, occupation forces. With the withdrawal of occupation forces, then my people will face 2 enemies, 2 internal enemies instead of 3. Then it will be easier for them to fight 2 enemies instead of 3. But no question, it will not be easy a struggle. But which is hope and clear that our people hate the Taliban and also the warlords. And now my message on behalf of my people to you is this, that as much as you can support progressive, democratic-minded people of my country, some parties, intellectuals that we have, through them support my people to bring women rights, human rights, and democracy in my country. History bears witnesses that only nations can liberate themselves. So now I would like to ask all peace-loving, justice-seeking, and democratic-minded organizations, groups, and intellectuals to join their hands with progressive and democratic-minded forces that need your solidarity and support. Therefore, my message to you is that now, please support my people as much as you can, especially support them educationally, because education is a key toward emancipation. Heartfelt thanks once again for your solidarity and support. Thank you very much.
It's a real honor and pleasure to be able to share a platform with one of the genuinely heroic people of the of recent years. So I'd like to thank some anonymous bureaucrat in the State Department for allowing that to happen. and also for making it possible for me to leave the discussion of the impact of the U.S. wars in Afghanistan to someone who really knows about it. And instead, I'll just keep to a couple of remarks on the consequences of the U.S. invasion beyond, including here, consequences that could be severe, even maybe awesome. It's worth bearing in mind that there is an emerging consensus in the United States and policy-making circles about what has to be done. It doesn't include everyone. It doesn't include General Petraeus, the head of the Central Command, and his officers. But we should bear in mind that he has a political career in mind, and there's a game plan that may well be in the back of his mind, and that is to be compelled to withdraw from Afghanistan without something that can be called a victory, and to be able to blame it on the civilians who stabbed him in the back at the last minute, just on the verge of victory. That's a very familiar story played over and over again. So I think it's, for that reason alone, plausible to discount the optimistic scenarios that are coming out of the Central Command. The actual consensus is different. It has several components. One is that the war is militarily unwinnable. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which rarely makes a public statement, actually had a press conference a couple of months ago in which they said that the security in Afghanistan is the worst it's been in 9 years, so bad that aid groups can't reach their victims. Hospital admissions and the internally displaced are both up by about 25% in the last year, according to their calculations, which they say are underestimated because they can't reach most of the country anymore. So in the parts they can reach, there's a very sharp increase last year. That was confirmed just a few weeks ago, by Robert Watkins. He's the outgoing UN deputy special representative of the Secretary General for Afghanistan. He's been there for some time. He also says the same thing, that the situation is, security situation is, and the humanitarian situation is the worst it's been for 9 years. He said that before the NATO surge, the insurgency was pretty much confined to the south and the southeast. The effect of the surge has been to spread it everywhere. Other reports are similar, and it's also recognized that the longer the war goes on, the worse it's going to get. Well, that's one element of an emerging consensus. The second element is an almost immediate consequence of that, that there simply has to be some kind of a political settlement. And this has been called for a long time, but it's now becoming more and more prominent in mainstream establishment discussion. The political settlement has to have two aspects, internal and regional. You may have seen an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of days ago by Lakhdar Brahimi and Thomas Pickering, who sketched out the reasons why there must be an internal settlement, and indicating some ways in which they think it might be done. They're important commentators. Lakhdar Brahimi is a very distinguished international diplomat, lots of experience, a sensible person. His analysis is worth thinking about. Thomas Pickering comes straight out of the center of the State Department diplomatic establishment. The regional settlement would have to include the neighbors of Afghanistan. That includes Iran, Pakistan, China, several of the Central Asian stands, as they're called, and also the near neighbors who are closely involved. That would be India and Russia. and of course the United States, but that's because the United States owns the world, so it has to be part of the settlement everywhere. That's been argued for a long time by specialists in the area like Zelick Harrison and others, but it's now coming to the fore, and I think it's fair to say that there is by now a kind of a general establishment consensus that there isn't going to be any military victory, and that there therefore has to be an internal political settlement of some kind. Afghans have been pressing that for a long, many years, and a regional settlement involving these powers. A third element of the emerging consensus is that the most dangerous consequence of the U.S. invasion is not just Afghanistan. The Afghans are suffering terribly, but there are much broader consequences in neighboring Pakistan. One good discussion of this, if you want a sensible analysis, is by Anatol Levin. He's a leading Pakistan specialist in the conservative but serious international affairs journal, National Interest. He's lived in Pakistan for a long time. He observes, as others have too, that the invasion in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and its spillover to Pakistan is destabilizing and radicalizing Pakistan. The drone attacks are extremely unpopular, raising huge objections. The pressure on the Pakistani army to invade the tribal areas, not for the benefit of Pakistan, but to help the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, is highly unpopular among the population and the military as well. According to him, there's overwhelming majority support in Pakistan for the Taliban, not the Afghan Taliban, not the Pakistani Taliban, not because they like them, but because they regard them as a legitimate resistance force against an alien occupation, which implies that if the alien occupation ended, the support would end with it. There's also enormous antagonism and hatred of the United States. Polls have repeatedly shown that this is extremely high in among the general population and expanding. And it's also shared by large sections of the military. The military in Pakistan, like most of the country, is based in, comes mostly from Punjab, the richest area, the most majority of the population, the center of pretty much the center of the economy, source of much of the military. And Pakistan, remember, is kind of patched together. It was patched together by the British. It's areas that have nothing to do with each other, and there are insurgencies all over the country. In many parts of the country, like, say, Balochistan, they don't regard themselves as part of Pakistan. They consider it essentially Punjab. But the base of the military, and the military is really the one stable institution in the country that's kind of holding it together. They're the core of Pakistan, and his analysis and that of others is that the antagonism to the U.S. War in Afghanistan, and also it's the way the U.S. is spilling it over to Pakistan, is leading to what could be a mutiny, in which case the Pakistani state would totally collapse. That is the one stable institution. He says one option might be that they would begin to provide military aid, serious military aid, to the Taliban. They're giving them some support now, but major military aid, and Pakistan is very heavily armed and could do it. And quote him, "It is this terrifying outcome that present U.S. strategy in the region risks producing." Not just the military, there's another major institution in Pakistan, the ISI, the intelligence system, brutal, harsh intelligence system, and they're antagonized too. There was a recent event which had a huge impact in Pakistan. It wasn't not too much made of it here. That was the Raymond Davis affair. Raymond Davis, after much lying and deceit, was conceded to be a CIA agent. In fact, apparently a CIA-trained assassin, and there are plenty of them around. According to what is the general belief in Pakistan, and I have heard this from very credible Pakistani sources, old friends and so on, the general belief is that Davis simply got out of his, he was being followed by ISI officers who don't like the idea of CIA agents running around their country. He got out of his car and simply murdered two of them, pulled out a gun and killed two of them, called in another car that was following, which ended up killing somebody else. Well, they were not particularly happy about that. In fact, that's deeply antagonizes not only the population, but the ISI, which is very much involved in Afghanistan, too. Well, actually, it gets worse. One significant, great possibility is that Pakistan will indeed fall apart. It'll move into ethnic conflict. The various regions are partly, as I mentioned, they're partly, there are uprisings in several of the regions. They could extend. If Punjab collapses, it'll get much worse. It could, they even think, turn into something like the Congo or Somalia. And remember that Pakistan has, it has nuclear weapons. In fact, it's one of the major nuclear weapon states. According to current estimates, it may have a greater nuclear capacity by now than India, and it's the fastest growing in the world in terms of nuclear weapons. Also, along with the rise of nuclear weapons, has been a process of radical Islamization. And it's significant. It's not a majority of the population, but it's quite significant. You saw examples of it in the last couple of months. The governor of Punjab, Salam Taseer, was assassinated. He was assassinated after he had condemned blasphemy laws, which are outrageous attacks. This happened to be used against a woman. He condemned it. He was assassinated. And there was a big uprising in Pakistan in support of the assassins. That included reformist elements. If you look closely, you'll notice that the demonstrators were, prominent among the demonstrators were the black-suited young lawyers who were, in fact, the ones who had demonstrated to oust the Musharraf regime. They were the reformers. They were now demonstrating in support of the assassin because he had, the assassin had killed the governor who had condemned the blasphemy laws. Shortly after that, another leading figure was killed, the only Christian minister in Pakistan, Shahbaz Bhatti, same story. He had condemned blasphemy laws, so he was assassinated. And again, the reaction was massive support for the assassins. Well, that tells you something about what's happening in the country. That's not the tribal areas. It's not the radical Islamist Pakistani Taliban, as they're called, in the tribal areas. This is right in the center of the country, among the leading reformist, educated sectors. All of this is part of the legacy of Ronald Reagan. During the Reagan years, the Pakistan was ruled by the most awful of its many horrible dictators, Zia-ul Haq, and he had two major policies. One was to carry out radical Islamization of the country with the funding of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the center of radical Islam and also the center of funding of jihadism and also the leading ally of the United States and Britain. Traditionally, the U.S. and Britain have been supporting radical Islam throughout the region. There are good reasons for that, and they continue to. The reasons are to, you can tell it from the internal documents, British and American internal documents. The reason is kind of a rational analysis. The real threat, they say, is the virus of secular nationalism. That's dangerous. secular nationalism, say Nasser, for example, can lead to the possibility of efforts to try to take the resources of the region and use them for their own populations, rather than for the benefit of the West and the ruling, super-rich ruling families. So that's a real problem. And the only barrier to secular nationalism, to the virus of secular nationalism, as it's called, is radical Islamism. So the US and Britain as well have been strongly supporting radical Islam for a long time and continue to. It's a little ironic when you hear them complaining about the Muslim Brotherhood, which by comparison is moderate Islam. And that remains true. Saudi Arabia, for example, has given free rein to crush demonstrations. No talk of no-fly zones. There was a day of rage called in Riyadh, but the police presence was so extensive that nobody could even show up. They're too intimidated. Same in Kuwait. These are rich oil states which have loyal dictators. So therefore, they're free to do anything they like. Bahrain is pretty much the same story. They're worried about the spillover to Saudi Arabia. And that's, you know, what happened there. Well, in this case, the Saudi Arabian funding of radical Islamism, which actually began in the early 60s, kind of a missionary effort to spread radical Islamic Wahhabi-type Islamism all throughout the Islamic world, massive funding, madrasas, you know, and so on, that penetrated Pakistan in the 1980s. And a lot of these reformist lawyers came out of those madrasas. They've had a big effect on Pakistan. And at the same time, Zia-ul-Haq was developing nuclear weapons. The Reagan administration pretended, and the British pretended, that they didn't know it. Of course they did, so that they could continue to fund their favorite dictator in Pakistan. Well, that these two, the development of nuclear weapons was in Pakistan was accelerated further in recent years as a result of a treaty between the U.S. and India, a nuclear treaty. India, of course, is regarded by the Pakistani military as their main enemy. In 2008, the Bush administration reached a treaty with India, which overturned U.S. law and international law on providing nuclear assistance to countries that do not sign, that are developing nuclear weapons outside the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as India is. So, a couple of years ago, the U.S. agreed to break that down, carried relevant international opinion along with it, and that meant that the United States can now provide and is providing direct assistance to India in the development of nuclear power. But everyone knows that the assistance on nuclear power development quickly spills over to nuclear weapons. The systems are pretty similar, and besides, it frees resources to be devoted to nuclear weapons. And in fact, the Indian nuclear weapon system has quite sharply expanded since then, as predicted. Well, everyone knew what the Pakistani reaction was going to be. That's their enemy, and it greatly overwhelms them in military force, military capacity. The Pakistani strategic analysis is they've got to try to counter it with a huge nuclear weapons program, and of course that expanded rapidly. As I said, now the most rapidly expanding in the world, and possibly already exceeding Indian nuclear power. That was extended by Obama. He, of course, persisted in pursuing the treaty, but went beyond. In September 2009, there was a Security Council resolution calling on all states to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. There are three that have not joined it, India, Israel, and Pakistan, nuclear states. So this called on them to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty to open their systems up to international inspection. Actually, the U.S., the Obama administration supported the resolution, voted for it, because it was primarily aimed against Iran. They're primary enemy. Well, Obama immediately sent delegations to Israel and to India to inform them that the resolution would not apply to them. They could disregard it. India responded by, wasn't announced at the same time, that they now had developed nuclear weapons with the same yield as those of the superpowers, thanks to the U.S. support that's coming along. That's Israel, obviously. So what's happening now is that these two primary legacies of the Reagan administration, the radical Islamization and the development of nuclear weapons, they're converging in Pakistan. And that's leading to what could be the ultimate nightmare. The nuclear weapons program in Pakistan involves, you know, tens of thousands of people. Plenty of them come from this radical Islamist background. The antagonism to U.S. policy, which is growing extensively in the country as a whole and also in its few stable institutions like the military and the ISI, those are all leading to a very threatening outcome. In fact, kind of the ultimate nightmare, that fissile materials will leak into the hands of radical Islamists. And Pakistani nuclear scientists, the leading peace activists, anti-nuclear activists, who are also nuclear scientists, regard this as not unlikely. That means nuclear bombs in London and New York and so on, not technically a very difficult problem if you can get hold of fissile materials. Well, that's what we're pressing towards. That was actually confirmed by WikiLeaks. Some of the most interesting revelations from WikiLeaks were from the American ambassador in Pakistan, Ambassador Patterson. She described the same processes. She pointed out that she supports the U.S. policies, completely supports them, but she did point out that the policies in Afghanistan and the spillover to Pakistan are, as she put it, risk destabilizing the Pakistani state and raising the threat that nuclear weapons will fall into the hands of Islamic terrorists against the background of the rampant anti-Americanism that's developing for the reasons I mentioned. Well, Yevin's own summary of this is that U.S. and British soldiers are dying in Afghanistan to make the world more dangerous for the United States and Britain, and in fact for the entire world. Well, that's another element of the consensus. The final element of the consensus is that this must continue. We have to move resolutely towards disaster. And that tells us a lot about our own society and its leadership. Thanks. It's not that the information is hidden. It's not that the information is concealed. I mean, everything I just said is on the public record. It's not, but how do you get it to the general population? Well, you know, that's what activism is about. That's the job of activists, whatever the issue is. You have to organize, you have to get out there and talk to people, set up or participate or initiate organizations and work on it. That's the way things happen. There's no magic tricks about it. It takes hard work, it's dedicated, it often succeeds. That's the answer. Familiar answer, we all know it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that today the world is very small, like a village, because of the internet. You know, we have this improvement technology that our message can cross the borders even without receiving any visa in many other obstacles, challenges that we are facing, but we if we want, we can help each other. We can join the anti-war movement organizations in our country. We can contact the democratic-minded journalists to do interviews with democratic-minded voices in Afghanistan, freedom-loving fighters in Afghanistan, and intellectuals, parties that we have still there underground. You can read some book about Afghanistan, first of all. It will help you to know about the history of the 30 years war, especially these warmongers. For example, I give you the name of the book of Robert Dreyfus' book, Devil's Game, Bleeding Afghanistan, Ghost War, Eyes for Infidel, my book. These books, at least one of these, if you read, it will help you to know better first the history of our country. For example, I'm talking regarding Afghanistan alone. Of course, that in many other war countries, they also need a helping hand. And through different ways, we can help each other. For example, you can contact with democratic-minded politicians. Huge difference between the wrong politician, warmonger politician, and anti-war politician, intellectuals who are in power, officials. You can contact them, through them, pass the message on your government, put pressure on your government to stop this war crime, stop these crimes that doing in the name of the American people and other justice-loving people. And with more details, I answered this question in my book just because of lack of time. Maybe here will be some other questions, because this is the main question from every audience around the world when I attended the conferences I face. And it's really important, because we need practical support, moral and also financial support for democratic parties, intellectuals, men and women who are still there underground. For example, alone my life story is enough for you to know on behalf of other freedom-loving fighters that how much obstacles, hardships, risks, challenges we are facing. But we are trying our best to bring women rights, human rights, democracy in our country, because we strongly believe, as always I'm saying from audience with loud voice, that no nation can donate liberation to another nation. We try to bring these values, but no question that we need your helping hand. Thank you.
Question for Malala, just about if you could say more about the sort of democratic forces or the resistance and rebellion movement in Afghanistan, and to Noam, Professor Chomsky, if you could perhaps speak more about how the policy, the U.S. Policy in Afghanistan fits in with sort of the broader context. Not only you spoke about India and so on, but also in terms of all of the demonstrations, the revolts in Yemen and in North Africa.
Hi, thank you. You go first, or I should? Your question was about democratic-minded forces in Afghanistan. Yes, we have a lot. More than democratic parties, we have democratic-minded intellectuals, personalities, high-educated professors, but there is no honorable job for them. Nobody supports them, especially this government, of course, but they have the big power of the people with themselves, the support of ordinary Afghan people. And democratic parties that we have, for example, Afghan Solidarity Parties, that democratic-minded parties, secular party in Afghanistan that... I told you that they organized demonstration in different provinces of Afghanistan, in Herat, in Jalalabad, in Kabul, in Mazar-e-Sharif, against the puppet regime of Iran, their brutalities, against Afghan and also freedom-loving Iranian, what they are doing there, that fascist regime, also against the occupation of the US and NATO. Hundreds of people joined them, as I told you earlier, but they have lots of security problem. Also, they have economical problem. They are the one who should be support. Most of them are young, the members of this party. The leader of this party is a young, well-educated person, brave people. They are his secret hero and heroine of Afghanistan, I believe. Rawa is another democratic-minded party, but feminist party. They also, their representative attending conferences abroad, in international conferences, Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, that they are still underground activists. They face many obstacles. I met one member of Rawa. She shared all of their problems with me, and we understand very well, as all of us facing every day. And also Afghanistan Justice Seeker Project, something like this exactly, that all the name is a little long, but they are also, they are active, that they are underground, and also they knock the doors of the every Afghan, Safar Afghans, that those who lost the members of their family, they collect documents, they work for the future, that to bring these criminals to the court, National International Criminal Court. Some democratic NGOs we have, they are social activists, but situation is political. Even children of Afghanistan can do politics, I believe. So like Haka, like OPAC, some other NGO, I know that they are not corrupt. Let's support them. See their websites, follow their activities. As much as you can support them. The glorious uprising which happened today, for example, in Egypt and Middle East countries, mainly, especially in some countries, work, they organize this uprising through Facebook, Twitters, and through different way we can help each other. As I told you, that no question we face so many risks and obstacles there. Their website, the name of their website, if you want later, I can give you, or you can take my email, mj@malalajoya.com. You can email me, I will send your links to their website. You can see their activities and help them.
Of course, the Afghan policy goes way back before the uprising. I mean, the general principle in the Arab world, was rather well stated by a former Jordanian official. He said, Marwan Muasher, he said, as long as everything is quiet, it's fine. You can do anything you want. I mean, the U.S. and its allies know perfectly well that opinion in the Arab world is pretty much like opinion in Pakistan. So, for example, in Egypt, 90% of the population regard the United States as their worst enemy, as the major threat to the region. 10% think Iran is a threat. Opposition to U.S. policy is so extreme that, again, in Egypt, about 80% think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons. And figures are pretty much the same throughout the region. Now, that's very well known. These polls are taken by leading U.S. polling agencies. They're released by very prestigious institutions, Brookings Institute and so on. Reporting is flat zero, at least the last time I had a media check done. But the planners know it, and that explains why the West cannot possibly tolerate functioning democracy in the Arab world. I mean, any kind of functioning democracy means popular opinion is going to influence policy to some extent. Well, you can't have policy influenced by results like that. In fact, it's kind of interesting to see the reaction to the WikiLeaks exposures on this issue. The exposures from WikiLeaks that got the big headlines and a lot of euphoric commentary were that the Arabs support U.S. policy on Iran, and they were referring to the Arab dictators. The fact that the population overwhelmingly opposes it, and to the extent that I mentioned, that's not even worth mention. So, and therefore we are proud and happy that the brutal, vicious dictators that we're supporting actually take the same view that we do, even though it's opposed by maybe 90% of the population very strenuously. That tells us something about ourselves. That tells us something about Harvard, MIT, you know, the general intellectual culture. The hatred for democracy is so profound that none of this even arouses a flicker of concern. Furthermore, it's not new. It goes back a long time. Back in the 1950s, President Eisenhower was complaining, it's all declassified since, about the campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world among the people, not the governments. The governments are okay, it was a command. And the National Security Council, top planning agency, explained it. They said there's a perception in the Arab world that the U.S. supports harsh and brutal dictators, and blocks democracy and development. And we do it because we want to control their energy resources. And furthermore, the perception is more or less accurate. And furthermore, that's what we should be doing. Well, that's the Moesher doctrine. As long as the people are passive and quiet, we can do what we like. Actually, that doctrine applies at home, too. You can get away with anything you like as long as people are passive and quiet. And we're seeing it happen right here in striking ways. Well, same's true in Pakistan and Afghanistan. When your favorite dictator is in trouble, there's a standard game plan. I mean, if it's somebody really valuable, like in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, as I said, free reign, they can do anything they want. If it's somebody who's dispensable, like Mubarak, what you do is support him till the very end. Then if he can't be maintained, say the army turns against him, what you do is send him out to pasture, issue ringing declarations about your love of democracy and so on, and then try to restore the old regime. It's exactly what's happening in Egypt right now and in Tunisia. And it's happened in dozens of cases over and over again. I mean, you know, Somoza, Marcos, Duvalier, it's kind of like a broken record. So yes, of course, that's what's happening now. Sometimes you can control it, sometimes you can't. If Pakistan collapses and is, as is feared by the ambassador and others, radicalized and Islamized further, and the nuclear weapons, you know, go wherever they go, then the world's in real trouble. The policies in the region are about the same as, you know, I mean, they're unchanging. They go back to the Second World War. You want to control as much of the world as possible, especially the regions have rich resources. Democracy is, you know, it's for ideologues and propagandists. You support it insofar as it's consistent with strategic and economic objectives. So it's fine in Eastern Europe where it, say, breaks up the Soviet Union, you get a new workforce you can exploit and so on, so that's great. But not in our domains, please. And that is so consistent, it takes genius to miss it, literally. And in fact, it's even recognized in serious conservative scholarship. And, you know, the whole region is, you know, maybe Afghanistan itself, they don't care that much about, except for its strategic position. But the whole region is central to global planning. That's why the U.S. has been supporting the Pakistani dictatorships for so long. That's why it's supporting nuclear weapons development in India, knowing that it's playing with fire. You know, you support nuclear weapons development in India and Pakistan, you really are playing with fire. They've already come quite close to nuclear war several times, and that spreads. And the issues remain. Primary issue is Kashmir. It's exactly the same issue. But that's not the way planning works. Security is a very, is not a high priority. There are much higher priorities. Again, it takes genius to miss this. And that's what we're seeing now. Well, it's certainly true that the easiest way to stop terrorism is to stop participating in it. And for the United States, that's easy. I mean, say, take the drone attacks. The drones are terror weapons. I mean, if we're sitting here, just use your imagination, if we're sitting here in this room, we don't know whether any minute bombs are going to start to fall from some undetectable source. That's a terror weapon. In fact, that's the advantage of it. It means people sitting somewhere in, you know, wherever they are, you know, Nevada or Southern California, can decide instantaneously to drop lethal weapons on some target that's given to them maybe by people like Raymond Davis, you know, CIA assassins on the ground. They can do it instantaneously. They can watch what's happening and go back to the bar and have a drink. That's a terror weapon. So sure, that's terrorism. And people react to it. Now, that's primary reason why there's such intense hostility to the United States and Pakistan and much of Afghanistan. And it goes way back. I mean, if we were honest about it, it's hard to imagine, but just a thought experiment. Imagine we tried to be honest about it. Ronald Reagan, Bush didn't declare the war on terror. He redeclared it. Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, announcing, his administration announced that a prime focus of U.S. foreign policy was going to be a war on terror, a war against state-directed international terrorism, you know, return to barbarism in our time, you know, plague of the modern age, and on and on. And they did. Turned immediately into a major terrorist war. Hundreds of thousands of people killed in Central America. In fact, the U.S. was taken to the World Court and condemned for international terrorism, unlawful use of force. That goes way back before that. I mean, the Kennedy administration launched a major terrorist war against Cuba right after the Bay of Pigs. Very serious. It's public. You know, the documents are there. Not, you know, Arthur Schlesinger, the official historian for biographer for Robert Kennedy, he points out that Robert Kennedy, the president's brother, was given prime responsibility for bringing the terrors of the earth to Cuba, and they did, and it went on. In fact, there's a major terrorist being tried in Florida right now, and not for terrorism, but for misleading border inspectors when he got into the country. Well, you know, we can go on, but these are major, persistent acts of terrorism. So if you want to stop terrorism, one way is just stop participating. It doesn't do everything, but it does a lot. Actually, the actions of the United States and Britain are undertaken with the foreknowledge that they're going to increase terrorism. So take, say, the Iraqi invasion. Intelligence agencies in the U.S. and Britain were well aware that the invasion of Iraq was going to very likely increase the threat of terror. That was known before, but it just came out more clearly in the Chilcot hearings in Britain. There's investigations going on of, you know, the background for the Iraqi war. There aren't here, but there are in Britain. And the head of British International Intelligence, MI6, testified straight out. Said, sure, of course we knew that the invasion was going to increase terrorism, and the CIA knew it too. And that was already known before, but that clarifies it. In fact, it did way more than they expected. So terrorism, what we call terrorism, what other terrorist acts that other people do, that increased by a factor of 7 the first year after the Iraq invasion, according to government statistics. But like I said, security is not a high priority. There are higher priorities, just like the threat of an Islamic bomb, you know, in New York. Well, you know, maybe, but it's just not a high priority. We got higher priorities. So as far as Israel's concerned, I don't think terrorism is a strong enough word for it. When, say, Israel invades Gaza, remember, that's a U.S.-Israeli invasion. Here it's called an Israeli invasion. That's not true. They're using U.S. arms, illegally provided, in violation of U.S. law as well as international law. They're relying on U.S. diplomatic support. So the U.S. Vetoed a blocked Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire, and ideological support. So here it's described as a defensive action by Israel, maybe overreaction. It wasn't a slightest pretext for it. The U.S. and Israel knew exactly how to stop the Qassam rockets that they claim were the pretext, namely agree to reinstitute a ceasefire. Under the ceasefire, there were no rockets. They'd prefer to bomb. Well, that kind of support means it's a U.S.-Israeli attack. Terrorism is not a strong enough word for it. This is we'd call that major aggression if anybody else did it. Same with the invasion of Lebanon and the occupation of the West Bank. It's just criminal. I mean, it's not even in question. You know, in fact, Israel conceded it 45 years ago that settlement in the West Bank is in violation of international law. It's been reiterated by the International Court of Justice, Security Council stated it explicitly, U.S. abstaining, and it's just not—it's not controversial. So it's a criminal act in violation of core principles of international law, and it's carried out by the United States and Israel, two of them. U.S. can't, Israel can't do it without direct U.S. participation all the way. In fact, the extent of U.S. participation was reiterated by Obama just a couple of weeks ago. There was a UN Security Council resolution calling for an end to expansion of Israeli settlements, which theoretically is supposed to be U.S. policy, and declaring once again that the settlements are illegal, which is not controversial. Well, U.S. vetoed it. Okay, that's our role, you know. So call it what you like. It's involvement in major criminal actions, very serious ones. Pakistan, anybody with their head screwed on is afraid of what's going on. The American ambassador, U.S. analysts, anybody who knows anything about it. What I described is just is not really controversial. You can ask why they're doing it, but you could also ask why the Reagan administration was supporting radical Islamization and nuclear weapons development. Why is Obama supporting India's nuclear weapons development, which of course spills back to Pakistan? They just have higher goals. It has nothing to do with brains. Whatever you think about Bush, his administration had as many gray cells functioning as the Obama administration. And in fact, Obama's policies, if you look at them closely, they're not very different from those of Bush's second term. Bush's first term went outside the spectrum. I mean, there is a spectrum of policy. It's not nothing. It's pretty narrow, but it's there. And Bush's first term just went off the edge. That's why it was so harshly criticized internally. Much more harshly criticized. The Iraq War was criticized internally within the establishment in ways that are very unusual. So, for example, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences right here in Cambridge published a monograph before the war condemning the war. I don't think they've ever done that in their 200-year history. There were major criticism in the major foreign policy journals. They just went overboard. And the second Bush term kind of came back to the mainstream spectrum, and Obama's continuing it. The general policies, as I mentioned, they go right back to the Second World War. I mean, I have no time to go through it here, but if you look at U.S. planning documents, they just haven't changed much since then. I mean, this is the Roosevelt administration. Planners in the Roosevelt administration expected that the U.S. would come out of the Second World War with a position of overwhelming power, that it would replace Britain, that it would be the world dominant power, and they sketched out plans for what they called a grand area that the U.S. would control, entire Western Hemisphere, the Far East, the former British Empire, which includes the oil producing regions, and the major sectors of Eurasia, Western Europe. And in that region, the U.S. Dominance would be unchallengeable. No exercise of sovereignty would be permitted in this area that conflicts with U.S. demands. And the demands were to create an international environment that would be conducive to the investor community, to resource extraction, and so on. And that continues without a change. So take, say, Clinton. He wasn't Bush. Clinton's doctrine was more extreme than Bush. Clinton's positions, directly stated, was almost quoting, was that the U.S. can undertake unilateral military action anywhere to protect access to resources and markets. I mean, that goes beyond Bush. You know, Bush said, well, we have to have some pretexts, you know, we're defending ourselves or something. Clinton, you didn't even need any pretext. But he said it politely, you know, and not arrogantly, and so it's fine. The Bush administration was extremely arrogant. kind of in your face. You do what we say or you're irrelevant, that kind of thing. Well, you know, European leaders don't like that. They like to be treated politely. So they're happy with Clinton, but not Bush. Obama's back to treating them politely, but the same policies. And they go far back. They've been applied all over the place. They don't always work. So U.S. power is much less than it was in, say, 1950. It's been declining, and the world's getting more complicated. But the same basic reasoning applies. And it's not terribly surprising. I mean, you know, foreign policy grows out of internal institutional structures. If you want to understand the foreign policy of some state, take a look at the distribution of power internal to the state. Well, it's no big problem to figure out where internal power is in the United States. Okay, we don't have to waste time on it. So sure, they're going to direct policy. This is an insight that goes back to Adam Smith, you know, like it ought to be taught in first grade. You want to understand policy, take a look at who's powerful inside the society. They're going to, by and large, dominate policy. And if it's right now financial institutions, multinational corporations, investors, and so on, well, there will be a policy designed for their interests, just as domestic policy is. No surprise. And that does not rank security very high. This is a serious flaw in international relations theory. If you study international relations theory, typically these issues are completely disregarded. And states are regarded as kind of abstract, following abstract interests, like what's called the national interest, as if the national interest of the CEO of General Electric is the same as that of the janitor who sweeps his floor. Well, you know, it's not. They have different interests. And as long as you kind of abstract away from these issues, you don't understand very much. But if you look at them, it's not terribly mysterious.
Regarding the question of our brother, let me add some point as Professor Chomsky explained very well. But regarding my country, you know, Afghanistan is in the heart of the Asia. And this is, I think, our sin. Because when U.S. as a superpower will have their grip, their military base, they are very powerful. So they can very easily control other Asian power like China, Iran, Russia, India, etc. Then very easily will have access to the gas and oil of the Central Asian republics. In the meantime, they changed Afghanistan to the center of the drug. Billions of dollars they are receiving through dirty business of opium as well. And they also have their grip on the our rich mines that we have. Natural mines that we have, the outcome of this also, unfortunately, do not benefit Afghan people. For example, in Helmand, there they found pure uranium that even between British troops and American troops, a kind of competition. Each of them, they want to have their own more troops there and keep this area unsafe that to have, of course, for their own interest, for their own benefit. And many other examples that, which is clear now, open secret, they occupied my country, as I said earlier during my speech, because of their own strategic, regional, and economic interest. Even because now the U.S. government is under the pressure of their people, and that this 10 years is not less than a big question for their own people, that why this war do not end if it's really the war on terror. So they are trying to do what they did, same like in Vietnam War, searching for a so-called honorable solution. Even now, they want to give the responsibility to the Afghan and police army. They want to use them as cannon fodder to decrease their casualty of their troops. That. Anyway, they want to make very powerful their puppet regime there. Then even if they leave Afghanistan, then their puppets are in power. Same what they did in Iraq. same that they will do in Libya and countless countries. If we read the history of the U.S. government, what they did, Afghanistan and Iraq, and now Libya is only 2-3 last examples. And that they destroyed democratic regimes and brought in power dictators, but in some country they destroy criminal regimes, but they bring in power more dirtier regimes, criminal regimes, than the previous one. And for example, regarding U.S. government election, I mean, last time that I was in the U.S., I think it was during the after the election or during the election when Obama had the beautiful banner, empty banner of hope and change. Unfortunately, a lot of American people, even anti-war activists, they become deceived by these banners. While I'm sure American people know very well that the faces is meaningless, never bring positive changes. This is the system. And you know the politics of U.S. government after each 5 years will not change. So that's why I wished, at least as intellectual, that progressive people, anti-war activists, they will not be deceived by faces. It damaged our struggle. You saw that for a while, for at least 2 years, it's not less that anti-war, some anti-war organization activists, even some of my supporters, they told me, Malala, because we fed up from this criminal Bush, we thought Obama is better. We became hopeful. Hopefully it will be a good lesson for all of us, good experience that do not be repeated again. At least now also, it's not too late if we will be united. When the fundamentalists, when the warmongers, when the criminals, they get unite, why we should not be unite? And let's to be unite with each other, continue more strongly against occupation, against warmongers in our country and also in other countries, join our hands, especially with those who are struggling, they are risking their lives, and try to bring these positive changes. Parties and intellectuals, let's support them, join your hands. Let's today conclude our event with the quote of this extraordinary man, beloved man like Martin Luther King, who always has quotes inspires me, and I'm sure millions around the world. He says, "There come a time when silence become betrayal." Thank you very much.